You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolensky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. Today we're talking about debugging tools and tips. So what are the different tools that we can use? What are the different techniques? What is the sort of the mindset that you need to put yourself into to debug a problem and get through it as quickly as you possibly can? With me, as always, today is Mr. Tolensky. How are you doing today, Scott?
I'm doing good. I'm doing really super good because when you're listening to this, I have a new baby girl, which is actually hard for me to talk about because she's not here yet. And, you know, like there's such a huge shift between, you know, the baby going to be here and the baby being here in terms of your actual mindset, in terms of just like how you feel about life. And like, yeah, it's hard for me to say. By the time you're listening to this, I'm going to have a baby girl. So I'm just going to imagine that I'm doing fantastic and I'm super duper excited because that's the energy I want to put out there. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to talk about debugging here. And this is one of my favorite topics. This is something I've always been very interested in. And I'm happy to learn a little bit more about debugging all the time. This episode is sponsored by a couple of our longtime sponsors, which is Netlify and FreshBooks, both of which we're going to be getting into later on in this episode.
All right, so let's get on into it. We're going to go through first different tools and different types of debugging. Then we'll get into some network requests, talk about the VS Code debugger, and then we'll switch more into some tips and debugging mindset and like how do you like what questions do you ask yourself and whatnot. So first thing is good old console.log. So it's kind of the joke that Scott put here, CLDD, which is console log driven development.
That's my style, man. That's my style.
when you're debugging JavaScript, or we can really like, we're going to pretty much be focusing on JavaScript here, but this obviously could work with pretty much any language that you were using. Console log is probably the most basic, where you run something, and then when something happens, you want to output some sort of data or some sort of information about what happened. And console.log, along with its other, I think we've got an entire episode just on the different console methods. There's console.warn, console.info, console.trace, console.timestart, group start, group end. There's all kinds of different methods in there. We won't go into them all that much, but that's the very basic. And I would say, like, what percentage of your debugging is done with console log?
The fact that I'm laughing there is not a good sign. I would say a decent portion because for some reason, I just haven't spent the time. It's so funny. The episode we recorded that's going to be airing in a week or so, we just recorded an episode on making yourself feel uncomfortable to grow as a developer. And here I am avoiding using the debugger because it makes me uncomfortable. So I would say a good portion of it. I even have, I think it's like a better console log or something. I have a console log extension on my VS Code and I remapped it to Command L so I can highlight. Or I can just have my cursor over a variable and I can hit Command L and it just outputs a console log with that, with a little indicator of where it is. And because that just little Command L is so like in my muscle memory, I use it way too much. I use it way too much. I feel really bad about saying that. But again, we all have our holes and things that we need to get better at. So a decent portion of my debugging is through console logging and some of the other stuff we're going to get into in this episode. But definitely I lean on it way too much.
Yeah. So I'm pretty proficient in all the different debugging methods. The other sort of one is debugger. We'll talk about that in a second. But in most cases, a console log is fine. I would say like 92.8% of my debugging is just done with console log. And I don't think that you should be ashamed of using console log because I think it's the handiest. And like if you're trying to debug a click, and you like you want it to run a couple times, it's totally fine. It's when you get into more advanced use cases where you're console logging a bunch of variables or you're trying to peer into the scope or like if you're trying to log so much information because you need all of that at that point in time, that's probably where you should reach for the more mature tools that are in the browser, which is debugger and break statement. So let's get into that now. Debugger in the browser is it's just like one, it's a statement, actually. It's just a word. You can type debugger in your as a line of code with a semicolon. And what will happen is if your browser has the dev tools open, it will freeze your website from running or your application wherever you had put that debugger command. That's what's called a breakpoint. It will break your code and pause the actual execution of the code at that point, and it will throw up a little screen on your browser. And at that point, you have a whole bunch of options as to what to do next. So there is the ability to just resume the code. So when it pauses, you have the ability to peer into things like the call stack, which a call stack is going to tell you which functions ran up until this point. So if you have a function that runs another function that runs another function that finally calls the one that your breakpoint ran, you can see exactly what led up to that happening. And you also see a call stack when you have an error as well. And that's super helpful because you can see the process of things happening. And then from that point on, you can actually keep going and you can just say, okay, run the next line of code or step into the next function or step over the next function. There's a whole bunch of buttons there that will allow you to skip over functions or step into the next function and keep running with that call stack, which is pretty helpful. So along with the call stack, we also have the scope. So the scope will show us any closures that have happened there. The scope will tell us what this is equal to. If it's a function and there's variables that are scoped to that function, it will show you all of that. And that's usually where people cringe, where they see somebody console logging 11 different variables.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, just throw a debugger in there. It will freeze and it will give you this nice interface for going through objects like Chrome DevTools or Firefox DevTools normally gives you. You can just sort of explore the objects as they were at that time. And I know that's also sometimes a problem in Chrome DevTools where if you console log an object, at the time of console logging, it was empty, but sometimes there's like a race condition where the object is actually, it shows full in the console, but at the time of logging, it was empty. And then you're like, well, I see the data right there. Why is it telling me cannot read property of undefined? And if that's the case, you need to freeze your entire thing so it doesn't give you a reference to that object, but it actually gives you the values of the time of running that thing.
Yeah, that's such a key one. I think that happens all the time for beginners. I mean, I think people will run into that. And that's one of the biggest like, it should work, but it's not working. What the heck is the problem? And the fact is that it was never working in the way that you intended it to. It was just the way that console log works. So, okay, I'm interested. I can throw a little debugger in my code and get some info. That sounds all good for me. I like it.
We should also say that you can also set breakpoints in the browser. So if you have like a website that you don't control the code to, you can't just pop a debugger in there. You can go into the sources tab of your developer tool and just click on the number. And when you click on the line number of that code, that will set a breakpoint. And then when you run that code again, or you refresh the page, the breakpoint will break. It will pause the code from running at that specific point. So breakpoints and debugger statements are the same thing. It's just, are you controlling it from the browser in the DevTools, or are you controlling it from your authoring environment, which is your VS Code or something like that?
So it seems like you can, do the click the little breakpoint in. I mean, there's like obviously the little breakpoint column in VS Code. If you've ever hovered over to the left of where the numbers are in any of your, I don't know about other text editors at this point, because I've just been so in VS Code world, you get that little red circle. And if you click that actually adds a breakpoint. But how do we connect VS Code to our Chrome debugger? Is that an easy do? Is that a hard do?
It's not as easy as I thought. So the way that it works is that you have to proxy your application through VS Code. So you run your own server, localhost 3000, and then you run a VS Code server, a debugging server. And what that will do is it will just proxy all of the requests through the debugger server. And then it allows you to do things like you get your entire console in VS Code. So you don't have to actually leave VS Code in order to see what's going on. You can set breakpoints by just clicking the line number on there. You can see call stack, you can see scope, all of the stuff that you're used to seeing in the Chrome DevTools. You can actually see all of that inside of VS Code. And if you have like, if you're working on like one project for months, absolutely set this up, because it's super handy to be able to have your authored code and your debugging information in the same window. There's lots of helpful information that's going on there. And you can just, you just start it up every time that you want to run it. It will connect to the Chrome debugger and you get basically all the info. Like the logic is still running in the Chrome DevTools. It just ports all of that information to your VS Code so you can see it in there. For me, it's too much of a pain to set up because the nature of the work that I do is that I obviously have a few big projects, but I'm always doing, like for my upcoming JavaScript course, I have like 50 demos or 30 demos or something like that. Yeah. And I can't set up a new one of these things for every single thing that I'm working on because it is a little bit of extra work, especially like when you don't necessarily know what port your app will be running on. You have to go ahead and change it. So I personally don't use that for any of mine, but I know people are absolutely in love with this feature of VS Code.
I'm thinking I'm going to need to set it up. I'm going to need to watch a bunch of videos and I need to get into this. Because as we were talking here, I threw a debugger into my app. I saved it and I watched as I got all this information. And to be honest, this was easier than console logging anything. So if it's
hey
easier,
everybody,
I'm
it's
in.
James Quick.
Oh, sorry. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
James Quick has an awesome YouTube video on setting it up. That's how I actually initially did it. And he's using my theme. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. James is a cool guy. Yeah. I know James.
We'll put a link to that one in the show notes.
Yeah. Shout out to James Quick. Yeah. I'm going to have to do this. And I want to, since Level Up Tutorials is the project that I'm going to be working on for a considerable amount of time here, I think it's in my best interest to get this connected to Chrome or get my VS Code connected to Chrome right away and start diving into this stuff. There is no more excuses. I need to make myself feel uncomfortable here and I need to get going on this because it's already pretty sweet. I'm already seeing the benefits of it and it's kind of ridiculous that I've avoided it.
Well, maybe we'll come back in like a couple months and get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know me. By then, I'm going to be like I'm going to be wearing t-shirts of the Chrome debugger and just totally all about it. So
that like breakpoints are probably the simplest version of it. You just click which line you want it to break on, but there's all kinds of different types of breakpoints when you're trying to debug. So a couple of handy ones are break on XHR requests. So if you're like, I want to know when this application is sending data. Like actually these like debugger tools are very, very handy when you're trying to figure out how another application works. So whether you're writing a scraper or you're trying to find a private API or you're just trying to figure out like what data is this thing sending about me, you can turn on these breakpoints to say anytime there's an XHR request, which is a fetch request or a jQuery $.get or anything like that, it will break. And at that point, you can peer into the request and then you can step into it and see what the result of that data is. So you can do that by just going into your Chrome DevTools. And in the sources tab, there is little breakpoints on the side here. And you see that there's breakpoints, which is code. And then there's also XHR fetch breakpoints. You can add those. You click on add and you can say break when the URL contains whatever it is. So if you want to see like, okay, who this app, if it's sending any information to ConvertKit, let me know exactly what it is that they're sending. So you could say break when this app sends something to anything with the URL of convert in it. And that can be very helpful as well as it can be very helpful for your own application. If you're just trying to figure out, like, let's say you get thrown into an application at work and you want to know like, when is this thing firing off the data? Because you can sit there for, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours and try to just like comb through the code. But like that's a big problem sometimes where you get thrown into a large project and you don't know where the code is to actually modify it. Yeah. So what you can do is you can say just set a breakpoint for whenever an XHR request goes off. And you can just sort of click through the app and anytime something is fired off, it will freeze and it will show you the code that was written in order to fire that thing off. And that will allow you to quickly find in your source code where that actual thing had been written.
Yeah. Well, I just went in here and I found the event listener breakpoints. And I think these are pretty sweet. I just selected, hey, give me pause on the next animation. And so I then clicked my play button because I had a breakpoint in there. I clicked my play button. The web page started to load. And since you know me, I have animations. It immediately stopped the moment that the next animation came in. And I thought that was really pretty slick.
Yeah, it's awesome. There's a whole bunch of other ones that we have here. you can break on attribute change. So if you want to know, like, this is something that happens all the time to me, like, what code is adding this class to this element?
Yeah.
And like, how do you answer that question? I don't know. Well, you just say, like, well, this element has a class of playing. You set a breakpoint and say break when a class changes, or break when an attribute changes, or you can set it to break when a child is modified. And at that point, you can just go ahead and start clicking through your application. And then whenever that class is changed or one of the child is changed, the whole thing will freeze up and it will show you exactly the code that had caused that to happen, as well as the call stack that led up to that happening.
Dang, I'm feeling like I'm missing out on all this stuff that I've been missing out on all this stuff. And it was so much scarier in my brain. I think it's so funny. Once everybody listens to that making yourself feel uncomfortable episode, they're going to have a whole lot of like context to what I'm saying right now, because this falls into exactly what this is almost like a companion piece to that episode in a sort of tangential way. It's hilarious. This just looks like it could make my life so much easier. And this is going to be a sponsor transition here, just a heads up. But another way you can make your life easier is via Netlify. Netlify is an awesome host that allows you to build, deploy, manage modern web projects. And we aren't joking. I mean, every time I have a project that I'm working on or something, this Netlify is the very first place I go to, because they make all the hard stuff super duper easy. Let's say you have a site, you want to throw it up. You just connect your GitHub repo to it. You give it its build command. And if it's one of these platforms that Netlify is very familiar with, such as Gatsby, well, it automatically detects that you have a Gatsby site, and it automatically adds your build commands, so you don't have to worry about any of that. And so if you have a Gatsby site in particular, I mean, there's other projects that work with this. So the Gatsby is just where we're very comfortable. If you have a Gatsby site, you can connect it to GitHub and deploy this thing in just about, like, I don't know, a minute or less. And that's unbelievable. This is the easiest way to host any front-end code. And Netlify is not all just about front-end code, because they give you the ability to add in all of the cool stuff that you need if you are using any sort of front-end code, because they give you the ability to have functions, which are serverless functions. You need some server-side code in here. You can deploy serverless functions instantly and easily. Identity allows you to have logins, passwords, signups, that sort of thing. Forms allows you to have contact forms in large media. Storing and saving large media, all this stuff is just super duper easy. Again, I think Netlify's big thing is that they just make everything that is hard about web development insanely easy. So you're going to want to check out Netlify at netlify.com/syntax and just let them know that you came from Syntax, because trust me, they love to hear that. We've spoke at the Jamstack Conf and we're big fans of Netlify over here. So again, if you use this for the first time and it blows your mind like it has most people that have checked this out, then go ahead and let them know that you found out about Netlify from Syntax. Thank you so much to Netlify for sponsoring this episode.
Next type of breakpoint is a conditional breakpoint. So if you want to break only when a variable is equal to a specific string, a number that is greater, something that is true, something that is false, you can do that. And you don't have to, like, let's say you say, like, I only want to pause this debugger if the event type was a mouse down. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted that, then you'd have to, like, go into your code and say, like, if e.type is equal to mouse down, then debugger.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, a block and that's its own scope. And you don't need to do that. You can just open it up and you can have a condition in there. And it's like any condition in JavaScript. And the browser will specifically do that for you. What other kind? I got a couple more here. You can break on event listeners. So, again, if you, like, one thing is my bank doesn't let you paste into password fields, which kills me because I use a password manager.
Yeah.
And like, how am I supposed to have a secure password if I can't paste into it? So like, I was like, I'm going to like reverse engineer this. So what I did is I took the input and I say break on paste event. And then what you can do is you can find the code that is stopping you from actually pasting the code. And then you can just go ahead and modify that locally to actually do it.
Are you hacking a bank, Wes? It sounds like you're hacking a bank.
I'm hacking a bank by allowing myself to paste my own password into the box. But like, it's just stuff like that. Like, it answers the question, like, where is the code for this? And of course you can just like spend hours poring over the code, or you can get really good at dev tools and breakpoints and figure out how to dynamically run them like that.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. You could even use, it's funny because you mentioned, I mean, we just talked about that. I said you could do the animation in the event listener, but you could do like anything in here. And it's a lot, and it looks like it has all of the new Chrome features. So it even has one for picture in picture, which is like kind of wild because picture in picture is like a brand new API to Chrome. So I'm fascinated by this. This is like kind of blowing my mind, and I'm feeling like a big old dummy, but this is really exciting. I think this is one of those things that if you are sitting at your computer listening to this, pop open your web app. If you're coding, throw a debugger in there. Try this out right now, because this is one of those things that I think is easier than people expect it to be. And I say that speaking from the perspective of somebody who expected this all to be more difficult. So it looks great.
I'm glad I could enlighten you.
Yeah, I'm feeling enlightened. Do you want to talk about the next section here about network requests, or do you want to stick on this for a little bit?
No, that's it. That's how simple it is. It's just breakpoints at different points in time. And if you know that a breakpoint is something that pauses your script from running and allows you to sort of peer into the code at that point in time, then you know all about breakpoints, and you just need to know that you can set them at different events and different exceptions and different conditions and different types of things like animations and fetch requests and whatnot.
I sort of feel like people who come from non-HTML and CSS backgrounds, like people who come from Java or any of these higher level programming languages, I feel like they're probably cringing pretty hard.
Well, it's the same when we're geeking over VS Code, having
like
very simple IDE features.
Yes, because these are things that are like very commonplace. But this is the web, and the web is evolving to a point where we now have the tools that, you know, real programmers have had for so long. It's funny because these are the tools that people have been using forever, and now we get to experience them in a way that is just like so enlightening, I think, is going to make our lives a lot easier. So another one that we wanted to touch on here in this episode was the network tab in your Chrome Developer Tools for debugging, because a lot of the times we're working with requests, right? We're sending requests for anything, whether it's an image, whether it is an API call, whether it is a service worker or something like that. We're grabbing something. And sometimes it can feel like why isn't this image loading? Why isn't this font loading? Why isn't this thing working? Well, we have access to every single request that's coming in and out of your website, how long that request took, if the request worked, the size of the file, the response, the headers. We have access to so much information in the network tab. So if you pop open your network tab, you give your page a refresh, you're going to see every single request that happened. And you're going to be getting the headers, the preview, the response, cookies or timing, that sort of stuff. And I use this constantly, and I know it's not just a GraphQL thing, obviously, but let's say one of my queries isn't working, specifically in GraphQL. I don't know why it's working. Maybe I could throw the Apollo to give me the error output or something like that. But if I don't want to modify my code in that way to have the error console log or something, you can always just pop open the network tab, and that failed request is going to be highlighted in red. You can click it, and it's going to tell you what the problem is right there. Right in your thing.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to navigate and find this thing. If you want to look at all requests for any given thing, you can filter it. You can say, hey, give me all of the script requests, or just give me the image requests or the media, the font. This was really super instrumental for me debugging WebSockets. If you use WebSockets, this is the way to go to figure out what is the problem with your WebSocket. I just get so much value out of the network tab.
Yeah, the network tab is kind of the console log of anything that gets fired off. And that's super helpful, even just to, like, sometimes if you go on like Instagram and you can't like right click save a photo, like I showed my wife this. She always like asked me like, how do I save this photo? Because they like did it as a background image. And I was like, okay, well, let's show you. And it was easy enough for her to figure it out. I was like, go to the network tab, filter for images, and then sort by size. Because probably the main photo is going to be the biggest thing on the page. And then you just kind of hover over them until you find the one that you want. Right click, open in a new tab. That's the reason why nothing is secure. Sometimes the photographers ask me, like, how do I protect my images from being stolen? I said, you can't. You're literally sending them to the person. You throw a big
old watermark.
Yeah, you're sending them to the person that's on the website. There's absolutely nothing you can do in order to save that. Actually, what's one thing that I did see was
blobs.
Who was it? Streaming? Yeah, someone was streaming a blob in and just displaying it in a canvas, which you can still export that canvas. But I guess it'll stop people. And then you just get people screenshotting a low quality version of it, which is maybe even worse.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Big fan of network. We talked about network tab in the scraping and what was that? What do we call that one? Scraping and like alternative methods. Let's find it.
Yeah, it was an interesting title.
The Undocumented Web, Scraping Private APIs, Proxies, and Alternative Solutions. That was episode number 60. Yeah.
Alternative solutions. That was the word.
Anytime you're trying to figure out how a website works, I honestly think this is like the view source of understanding how servers work, because you want to know like what data are they sending? Who are they sending data to? When are they requesting it? What's happening on page load? All of that information gets shown cached? In the network tab.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it cached? Is it not? You can also, in the network tab, you can dumb it down to like 3G or Edge just to see what your website looks like. The dev tools are so cool. We need to do like an entire show on every tab.
Every single tab.
Because like there's the performance tab. There's the memory tab. We've talked about the elements tab, the console tab, and the sources tab a lot. But there's more tabs out there, Scott.
Yeah. And one of my favorite things to do in the network tab is to just see what's taking a really long time. Because maybe you have a request that could be like an image, right? Maybe you have an image that's taking a lot longer than you. I mean, maybe you just see it and you're saying, wow, this image load is actually taking up a large percentage of the overall load of my entire page. And maybe that's like a little message to you that there's a different way. Maybe you should be loading this image. Maybe you should be optimizing it. Maybe you could be serving like a WebP to those of you who use Chrome or to your users who use Chrome. I check out this all the time, specifically for images, compression, those sort of things, seeing what's cached, what's not cached, just generally tuning my performance, even though this is the network tab and not the performance tab. But yeah, I'm a big fan, in case you can't tell.
Next up, we have just like the debugging mindset. Mm-hmm. So tools aside, you just have to think properly in terms of how do you fix things. We've all had that experience, whether it's in code or just something else in life, where you work forever on something and someone comes over and you just explain the problem to them, and then they just start firing off questions to you. Did you try this? What happens when you do this? What color is this? What, you get the point, right? They're just asking lots and lots of questions. And that type of person is really good at sort of just like triage into figuring out and, I don't know, distilling down the information as to what went wrong.
And
being a person who can ask the right questions, like that's just, it's amazing how quickly you can get to the root of the problem if you know what questions to ask. And I think that's a huge skill in being a developer. That's something you should probably constantly be working on. And that's the mindset. So what are some good questions and some good things that you can do in order to sort of narrow down the problem?
Yeah. So, I mean, my experience in this has started like even from a non-web perspective. One of my jobs was that I managed and maintained projectors in an auditorium and for doctors, right? And doctors have a lot of problem with technology. They would plug their thing in and it wouldn't work. And so a lot of times I was having to debug or troubleshoot these issues in front of an entire auditorium full of doctors. Meanwhile, they're all very busy and, you know, wanting this thing to move on. And so you feel the stare of 10,000 eyes of everybody just looking at you while you're standing in front of a computer, right? And so a lot of the processes that I've learned in code have come from even those situations and how to find the problem in a situation. It's almost universal even throughout code. And typically it helps to have maybe a set of checklists, or maybe not like an actual checklist, but just a set of steps that you go through and that you can use to figure out your problem. Like what kind of stuff do we debug? For instance, like CSS, right? Something's overlapping something else. Well, there's a number of ways that you can look at this thing, whether it's in your inspect element, and then you go into that 3D view and you can see where it is on the DOM, or one of the helpful tools that one of my mentors told me about, which it seems kind of dumb, but just start giving things either borders or backgrounds of primary colors. And there's an extension that I have that actually just wraps all of the divs and everything in a box. And so you could see the boundaries of every single thing on your page. And once you can see the boundaries and look at these things and see the whole big picture, to me, that is the best way to start debugging and get this debugging mindset, is to have a view of what the thing is actually doing. Because we look at our code, we look at our website, and we look at the output, but we don't always look at, all right, what is the thing actually doing, so that you can take a look and actually start solving some of these problems.
I just got a little example that I've got here for something. This is when I taught in the boot camp, this would always happen. Someone would call me open and we'd be doing something with APIs. And they say, when I click the button, it used to go off to the API, fetch a joke and display the joke on the page. And now when I click it, it doesn't work. Mm. And you're just like, okay, well, what have you tried? Nothing. Okay. Or what's the thing? I've tried nothing and I'm all out of ideas.
Yes.
But so like, what's my thought process for tackling something like that? So you click a button, it fetches some data, comes back and displays it on the page. So first, is your click working? Is the event listener actually working, right? Like, don't automatically think the API is broken or something, or go to the very end and think like the whole thing is broken. You just have to take it down. So is the event listener working? So how would I do that? Probably just console log clicked at that point and just make sure that your event listener is working. If that's working, is the request firing? So go into the network tab and then go ahead and click it. And usually what I'll do is I'll clear out the network tab and then I'll click it and then see if a request forms there. And if that shows, I say, okay, well, are you sending the right data? So in that case, I'll maybe throw a breakpoint in there and see what data is currently being sent off to that request. Is the data in the right format? So sometimes you are sending the data, but you're sending it as it's misnamed. Maybe you have a spelling mistake in there. Maybe you've camel cased it when it shouldn't have been, things like that. So that's good. Is the request being sent properly? So you can click through the network request and sometimes it will just tell you like a 407 or 404 or whatever error, it's unauthorized. You're sending it to the wrong endpoint. Your API key wasn't sent along. Your API key was undefined. I've seen that all the time. So if that's the case, then you know that that's a problem. So if it is being sent, you say, okay, then what is the response? There's another tab in the network for responses, and that will allow you to see if the data has come back from the request properly. If that's still good, then you go in your function that handles the sort of the callback or the async await, and you can console log or throw a debugger in there and see if the data is being there. And then finally, if you still have the data there, then obviously it's a display issue. You go into the function that displays the data, right? So like that was like 8 different steps that I took there where you seemingly a small problem. It doesn't work when I click this button, but there's so many different things, and being able to isolate it and sort of step along each step in the process is super important as a developer.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was like inferring when I was talking about having these steps, right? I mean, something you click doesn't work. Well, okay. The first thing you need to make sure is, right, like you said, hey, is the click even happening? And once that's happening, you can go from there. And it's all about this idea of getting the minimal part of it working, right? Get the least amount of stuff working and then add on and keep going as you go from there. Okay, did this work? Okay, yes, this worked. And then next step. Did this work? Okay, yes, this worked. Then next step. And that allows you to really find exactly where the problem is. And this can happen a lot in React where you have an issue and the issue might not immediately be apparent where it lives. And you might be thinking, okay, well, you know, I think this is in this component, but well, I can't be sure. And when I do this, it doesn't fix it. So in those kind of situations, what I start to do is I go into maybe like the upper level of maybe my routes. And let's say I have all of my header, my footer, my main section, my whatever this, I just start commenting those out. And it's so easy to comment them out. I just command backspace or forward slash or whatever. So command, whatever, and comment all that stuff. You reload. Okay, the page still isn't working. Well, that means the problem is not within any of those things. So you can, you know, you can either leave them commented out or you can uncomment or whatever. But the idea here is to start getting rid of every single thing until you have something that works. And then once your code starts to work, then you have a minimal working example. Once you have a minimal working example, you can work backwards from that and you can start uncommenting things until it breaks. And then the moment it breaks, then you know exactly where the problem is because, hey, you just uncommented this component out and now the whole thing breaks. Well, that gives you a hint that that's where the problem is. And so that's a really good a tip that I like to do is take a look and just remove everything and see, slowly add stuff back in until it doesn't work anymore.
Other things is if you're having a problem with trying to debug something, take it outside of your application and try to replicate it in like a code pen or something like that. I think that's super helpful, is just being able to build a use case of the problem. And almost always as you're building the use case, by isolating it, you figure out what the problem is, or you figure out, okay, well, this works on its own. So it obviously isn't this code right here. It's probably something totally different. I was working on a bike yesterday and I was switching the derailleur, which is the thing that moves the chain. And I took a broken one off, put a new one on, and it didn't work. And I was like so frustrated with it. So I took it off and put another one on and the same problem. And then I was just like, what is going on? I like was going all over it and tuning it and playing with the cables and everything. And then I realized like, oh, the issue was with the shifter not being tight enough. Had nothing to do with the actual thing I had spent the last half an hour on. I was like, that's the perfect example of taking a step back and saying, huh, this thing isn't working, but it might not be this thing. It might be something else that's actually causing the issue. And I thought like, man, I can't wait to talk about this on the podcast because this is the silliest example, but it happens all the time to us as developers.
Yeah. Another one that I just like is usually the thing breaks when you change something, you know, like it worked before, you change something and it breaks. I've had issues where like I changed something in the body. This is just like a non-real example, but it illustrates it. You know, let's say you change something in the main section of your site. And then all of a sudden the error that pops up is something about your navigation or your header. And you might be thinking, well, I didn't change anything in the navigation or header. How could it possibly be broken? Well, chances are there might be some connection to some connection to some connection that leads to the error being thrown in the header. But even though the error is because of something you wrote in the other section of the site, because that happens to me all the time where the error response that I'm getting is not necessarily exactly helpful, but I just changed this other thing. So what you don't want to do is you don't want to then jump into the header code and start tweaking that code if you didn't change it in the first place, because chances are it's not broken if it was working fine before. Stuff doesn't break without you touching it. So going backwards in time, looking at previous Git commits, this is actually one of the huge benefits to committing very frequently. You know, commit when your code's working and commit frequently. And then at any given point, you can always go back at your code and say, wait, what did this file look like when it was actually working? VS Code has that little icon in the top right that looks like what the heck does that icon look like? It's called Open Changes, but it's got like two little arrows and circles. It sort of looks like a refresh icon with arrows in it. But if you click that, it shows you the same file in the previous commit with some green and red diffs to show you what's different, what changed. And I use this nonstop when I'm troubleshooting because if like something is broken, I click that button and I say, okay, this is what I changed. So therefore, the problem that I'm running into must be something in these sort of lines. And if worse comes to worse, one thing I'll do is I'll just straight up go into the previous commit. I'll select all, I'll copy it, I'll paste it into the current version of the file, and I'll confirm that it's working. And then once you confirm that it's working, then you can Command Z, undo that copy and paste, and then begin to know, okay, well, at least it definitely works with this last commit. It definitely works with this previous code. So at the end of the day, I can always come back to this as sort of my baseline of something that actually worked.
Next one is, we talked about this before, rubber duck debugging. This is simply put a rubber duck on your desk and explain the problem to it. This is, I always have this where I have the issue, I can't figure it out, and then I have to explain it to somebody else so they can help me. And as I'm explaining it to them, I figure it out. Because by forcing yourself to talk through an issue, even if it's to a rubber duck on your desk, it forces you to think about all the moving parts, and that will usually jog something in your memory and say, oh, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes your rubber duck can be another human being, like my wife, who may as well be a rubber duck when I'm rubber ducking, debugging with her, because she doesn't need to listen to what I'm actually saying. It's like, I need to just be saying it out loud for it to be helpful, right? She's not going to give me the answer. It's the fact that I'm telling her a bunch of this stuff is what's going to help me with the answer. You know, she would probably prefer that I had an actual rubber duck to do this with, though, because I don't think it's exactly a good use of her time. But yeah, I think that's it for debugging. Do you want to get into our last sponsor here, which is FreshBooks, the freshest of our sponsors?
FreshBooks is the freshest of the books that you out there. If you are a small business, you're a freelancer, someone who needs to keep track of all of your expenses, all of your invoices, all of your time tracking, who's paid, who's not, actually accept money online is one thing they do via PayPal and Stripe and all these things. FreshBooks is what you want to check out. I use it all myself. I just finished up my taxes and I just did one big dump of all of my information, sent it off to my accountant. He saw all of my income, all of my expenses. It's just a great way to stay organized with all of your accounting. Check it out at freshbooks.com/syntax to get a 30-day unrestricted free trial. And thanks so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring.
Thank you, FreshBooks. Cool. So this is the part of the show where we like to get into sick picks, which are picks that we find to be sick. They're things that we like. It could be anything. Like anything. I think your sick pick here really illustrates that. I think I've sick pick a lawnmower before too, to a little spoiler about what's a sick pick is going to be. So do you want to get into your sick pick?
Yeah. So my sick pick is the DeWalt lawnmower, which is an odd thing that they sell. I didn't even know they sold one. I've talked in the past how I'm on the DeWalt brand just because I have lots of batteries. And once you buy into batteries of these tools, you sort of have to stick with that set of tools because the batteries are so expensive. The tools aren't really all that expensive themselves, the batteries. So we were looking for a new lawnmower and we have a pretty tiny little lawn, one in the front, one in the back. And it takes like, I don't know, 7 minutes to mow it. And we had a push mower. And that thing sucks. It doesn't do a good job. And I sharpened it and everything. And it's a lot of work. And
I can't imagine doing that.
The push mower sucks. It seems really cool. And then we got electric one with a cord. And I grew up. I had a lawn mowing business when I was a kid. And I hated the thing because there's always a cord where you want to mow. And it just gets in the way all the time. You always have to like flip it over and it unplugs and you're like tethered to the wall. And
we've always been lawnmower blessed over at my house, I guess.
Yeah.
We've never had to deal with a plug-in one.
So frustrated with electric. I grew up with electric and I used it for my entire lawn mowing business that I hated it. And I ran over the cord so many times. So, and also just like the setup of getting the cord out and plugging it in, moving it around, it took more time than actually mowing the lawn. So I thought, okay, like we need to get a gas one so that it's just quick. But the problem with gas is that like you have to maintain it and you take the fuel out in the winter and make sure that you mix the oil and everything properly. And that's a bit of a pain as well. So I was like, I think that these electric lawnmowers are at a point now they're good. So I went and researched all of the different ones out there. I know Ryobi has like a decent one, but I found out that DeWalt now makes an electric lawnmower. It takes two batteries. It came with two of the big beefy 5 or 6 amp hour batteries. You slot it in and it's relatively quiet, much quieter than a gas one for sure. And I think it's even quieter than our old electric one. And the sort of the kicker was that they are super cheap refurbished because the reality is that the batteries don't last all that long if you have a medium to large size yard. So there are tons of people who return them after using them one or two times. And we just went and bought a refurb for a couple $100 less than a brand new one would cost, just because a lot of people actually return these. And it came with brand new batteries, not the old used ones. So I thought that was really cool to be able to buy it. I've mowed the lawn 3 times and I'm only a third of the way down my battery. So I figure for our small little lawn, I can get 2 or 3 months out of a set of batteries. Though if you have a large lawn, I've seen reviews online. People can't even mow their entire lawn in one battery charge, which if that's the case, then
That's a big, yeah, that's a big one.
That's a huge downside. You're not going to spend an extra, like the batteries themselves is an extra $200 or $150 for a set of batteries.
Batteries, right? They're rechargeable.
Yeah,
right?
But like you can't like stop mowing your lawn halfway through and wait for 4 hours to charge these things. So yeah. I think that's why. But if you have a small lawn, highly recommend it. DeWalt, it's a 40-volt lawnmower. It's takes two regular 20-volt batteries and I slot in. Big fan.
Yeah. I use the Ego one, EGO.
Yep.
And
that's the Home Depot brand, right?
Yeah, they're at Home Depot. I think it's a Chinese company, but they're manufactured in Michigan. So that's sort of like backwards. But they're pretty cool. You know, the thing that like blew my mind the most about mowing the lawn with an electric or battery powered lawnmower was I've always mowed with a gas and you smell that gas. It's like coming up in your face. And the thing to me that like blew my mind was just how awesome fresh cut grass actually smells while you're mowing the lawn and cutting the grass. And also the sound benefit too. It's so much quieter and it smells so nice. I love everything about my battery powered lawnmower. So
yeah, I want to get a blower too, because like kids, I can't blow the backyard when my kids are out, cause they start screaming cause it's too loud. Dude, and
mine is so good.
Yeah.
I have the Ego one again with that. And it is so powerful that I used it as a snowblower this year. I did not bust out my snowblower at all. I just used it to do snow all over the place. And I love having a very, very powerful leaf blower. It's like something that I just never imagined that I would actually use that much, having a powerful one. Cause I had kind of a weak one before. Now I have a nice, powerful one. Big fan. My sick pick today is going to be something to get you energized for the day. It's a cold brew coffee maker. These things are just like really cheap and amazing. It's a giant ball jar. Like when I say giant, this thing arrived, it is the largest ball jar I've ever seen. It is monstrous. And then it has like a giant double layered filter and then a little like lid popper. And so what you can do is just basically throw coffee in here, throw water in here, put it in the fridge, let it cold brew. And then you have concentrated cold brew coffee. Ooh. It's $25 for the biggest one. And how easy is that? It's so easy.
It's two quart, which insane measurement is about 2 liters.
I think it's 3 liters.
Is it? I'm just Googling 2 quart to liter, 1.89 liters.
Oh, it says, liters. Yeah. What am I
thinking? Yeah.
I don't know what I'm thinking.
Get on metric, Scott.
Yeah, I know. I would love to live your life.
That
my whole life is based around Imperial. Is that what it's called? I don't even know what it's called. It's a whole thing based on dumb measurements.
Inch liters and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, inch liters. I'm all about inch liters. No, this thing is super easy, super nice, super cheap. If you like coffee, you like cold brew coffee, man, get yourself one of these. Beats throwing in a jar and having to filter it later. Yeah, that's all I got. Shameless plugs today. Do you have any shameless plugs?
I'm going to shamelessly plug all of my courses, westboss.com/courses. Check them out. JavaScript, CSS. You can learn it from me.
JavaScript, CSS,
JavaScript,
node modules, breakdancing, barbecue tips.
We need to make another one of those. If someone has an idea of like a silly thing to do, I think that would be really funny.
Silly. Silly is good. My shameless plug is the latest course from Level Up Tutorials. If you want to learn React Native from a React Native expert, you're going to want to check out Level 2 React Native. And this one is not a course from me. It's a course from Spencer Carley. And he has done such good React Native content. His React Native content is so good that it's the way that I initially learned React Native myself through his videos. He's got a ton of work on YouTube. So if you want to see if his teaching style is for you, just check out his YouTube channel. I'll have a link to Spencer Carley's YouTube channel in this video. But if you want to learn React Native, we get into all sorts of amazing stuff in here. Swipe gestures, add and removing items from lists, persisting lists with async storage. We use hooks in this course. So Spencer has done just a great job of using modern React and modern React Native. So if you're looking to level up your React Native skills, check out Level 2 React Native on Level Up Tutorials right now.
All right. I think that's it. Thanks for tuning in. We will catch you next week.
Catch you later.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.